Marxist scholar involved with revolutionary socialism and Marxism for a number of decades. He has written extensive essays on topics ranging from an assessment of the philosophy of science and other topics. He has also taught philosophy at the New Space, the New School for Pluralistic Anti-Capitalist Education, and his talk will be on socialism and human nature. So everyone, Alex Steinberg.
I'm just giving out a few visual aids. There's a Simpson alienation diagram, and there's a table of different answers to the question of human nature. I'm going to present a paper on alienation and Marxist theory of human nature. If some of you heard me at the last panel, there is some overlapping here, but the focus is somewhat different. So I hope you will stay. There is something odd about giving a presentation on a topic whose very existence is in question. I am presenting two such papers today at the Left Forum. My earlier presentation was on a panel titled, Is Socialism Possible? That panel tried to maintain the semblance of neutrality by raising the topic for discussion as a question. Here, I will be exploring the implications of something that many commentators, both supporters and opponents of Marx, claim does not exist, namely, a Marxist theory of human nature. I make no claims to neutrality on this question. I will, however, go over a number of the arguments made by the denialists of a Marxist theory of human nature and try to show why they are mistaken. I will, in no sense, go through all of the arguments or any of the combinations. Some of them are listed on that visual aid I'm giving out. I'm not going to necessarily touch on all those issues. I will then try to develop the central theoretical framework of such a theory and work out its theoretical and practical implications. I hope in the end to demonstrate that a proper theoretical orientation in a Marxist theory of human nature is a necessary foundation for a coherent revolutionary socialist orientation. Before we examine the objections, it is necessary to offer a preliminary definition of what we mean when we speak of a Marxist theory of human nature. The primary source is Marx's early unpublished notebooks, known historically as the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844. We've had allusion to them already. Charles was nice enough to read a good number of passages from those notebooks, so that'll save me some of that work. Now, there is no finished section in any of these notebooks with a title like The Theory of Human Nature. That's not really surprising, since these notebooks were not, first of all, primarily a philosophical work, and they chronicled a series of ideas that Marx was still struggling with. It's not, in that sense, systematic. However, extrapolating from the historical and intellectual context of the network of problems with which Marx was then engaged, we can deduce a theory of human nature out of his remarks on political economy and alienation. The first thing to note is the intimate connection between the critique of political economy and alienation for Marx's statements about alienation are never about a supposed human condition that has always existed and will continue to exist throughout eternity, but are directed to the historically specific form of bourgeois social relations. Marx writes, "The alienation of the worker in his product means not only that his labor becomes an object, an external existence, but that it exists outside him, independently as something alien to him, and that it becomes a power on its own, confronting him. It means that the life which he has conferred on the object confronts him as something hostile and alien. Alienation, as the condition in which human beings face each other and themselves, as well as the products of their labor, is thus a necessary vantage point from which we can get a grasp of what Marx means by human nature. After all, why is it a problem to have a power confronting you as something alien to you unless that power belongs to you in the first place? And what exactly is the nature of that power that belongs to you? As soon as we consider this question in this way, something strange happens, a phenomena that should be familiar to students of Marx and Hegel. An inversion has taken place. We are first led to a consideration of human nature in reflecting on what this power could be that has become alien and hostile to us. From this point of view, alienation appears to be a necessary framework for a consideration of human nature. But further reflection gets us to the opposite standpoint. If we ask ourselves, what is alienation in the first place, we are led to consider, what is this power that belongs to us? And it then becomes clear that it is only if we can answer that question that we can get a grasp on alienation, which is, after all, something relative to this power. Thus, an understanding of the power that belongs to us, which is just another way of saying human nature, is more fundamental in some sense than the concept of alienation, because the latter only derives meaning from its relation to the former. Furthermore, the two concepts need each other in the same way that an understanding of the disease state of an organism requires an understanding of that organism when it is healthy, and not simply in the sense that health is considered to be an absence of disease. If the notion of alienation is to have any meaning other than an expression of discontent, and the latter is what many commentators think was all that Marx was doing, that is, giving voice to the wretched state of workers during the terrible decades of the Industrial Revolution, then it must be placed within a conceptual framework that relates it to the social organism as a whole. If we can demonstrate that alienation is in fact a perversion of human nature, and one that is necessarily imposed on us by and through the social relations of bourgeois society and is not simply a state we are condemned to endure until we are redeemed from original sin, then the implications are clearly revolutionary. The restoration of our health as human beings, as a human society, is only possible if we replace the social relations of bourgeois society with social relations that allow for and encourage the full flowering of our human nature. That was clearly how Marx interpreted his discussion of alienation. He points out in the 1844 manuscripts that bourgeois social relations are a perversion of what man truly is. He says, it is only because man is a species being that he is a conscious being, that his own life is an object for him. A strange labor reverses this relationship, so that it is just because man is a conscious being that he makes his life activity, his essential being, a mere means to his existence. Man's essential being, what is here called, following the formulation of Feuerbach, species being, and by this he means to differentiate what man is in essence from other forms of animal life. So man's species being is seen as the reversal of the alienated social relations of bourgeois society, and these are in turn a reversal of social relations as they should be if we were to live in a society that was in accordance with our human nature. Many years later, in Volume 3 of Capital, we are given another depiction of social relations as they would develop in a free society that has transcended bourgeois social relations. Charles is already kind enough to read that passage, so I will not read it.
You're welcome.
If these two quotes are taken together, written more than 25 years apart, they should demonstrate that Marx held to a fundamental conception of human nature and its alienation throughout his life. He posited that a society free from alienation, one that is in accord with our human nature, is only conceivable once bourgeois social relations, that is, relations regulated by the law of value, have been overthrown. If this key foundation of Marx's theory of alienation is ignored, then what are we left with? Well, one interpretation, one that has been championed both by Marxists and non-Marxists, is that Marx's writings on alienation in his 1844 manuscripts are not an essential part of his theoretical work, that they are somehow external to his theoretical work in discovering the laws of motion of capitalist society. Instead, Marx's discussion on alienation in the manuscripts is considered as descriptive of the times of Dickens, having no explanatory value. Such an interpretation may leave us with an admiration for Marx's humanity, but there is nothing inherently revolutionary about it. It is perfectly compatible with a liberalism that has sympathy for the plight of the exploited, but thinks that modern democratic society has gotten beyond the worst evils of the heyday of capitalism. This line of thinking may catch even those sympathetic to Marx unaware, and by accepting it, they undermine the revolutionary content of Marxism despite their best intentions to the contrary. I will cite just one example of this tendency. There are many others. The example I wish to cite is that of the English Marxist Alex Kolinikos. In a book written in the 1980s, Kolinikos said that in his early writings, Marx held to a concept of human nature which was supported by a metaphysical philosophy of history for which Kolinikos had little sympathy. He clearly doesn't like the word metaphysical. Kolinikos goes on to claim that Marx, in his more mature writings, was able to overcome this metaphysical concept that he inherited from Hegel and Feuerbach and replaced it with what he calls a scientific research program. Kolinikos asserts that in his mature years, when writing Capital, Marx's theory of human nature plays no directly explanatory role. Instead, and this is a quote, Marx's metaphysical theory of human nature provides the philosophical rationale of a scientific research program whose main concepts, the forces and relations of production, serve to specify the historically variable forms in which social production is organized and admit of empirical corroboration and refutation via the falsifiable hypotheses they generate. I'll just say one thing about that. How a metaphysical and speculative conception of human nature can become the basis for a scientific research program, this is something Kolinikos does not explain. Kolinikos is representative of a number of interpreters of Marx who value Marx as a scientific theorist, but have trouble reconciling that with what they consider the more speculative, quote, metaphysical claims of his early works. But Kolinikos' attempt to bridge the gap between the two Marxes collapses into incoherence. It would have made more sense to abandon any attempt to bridge the two Marxes and take the path of Althusser and many others. That is to simply reject the early writings as products of immaturity, having no scientific value in comparison to the later writings. The only problem is that although this position may be more logical, it flies in the face of the textual evidence that shows that the later writings are also infused with the so-called speculative and metaphysical conception of human nature. I don't have the time, of course, to fully make that case in this brief presentation. You'll simply have to follow me along this path for a while. Let us then suppose that we have satisfied everyone that Marx's concept of human nature grounds his theory of alienation and his critique of political economy with which it is intertwined. But that in itself tells us little about the content of human nature as understood by Marx. His positive descriptions of human nature are very general and rather vague. And I don't mean to contradict Charles when he said Marx has a psychology. There are the rudiments of a psychology in Marx, but there's certainly no systematically worked out theory of psychology. After all, what is a society? What is a society of freely associated producers really like? What does the life of our species look like once we have overcome alienation? All we have are some poetic images about hunting in the morning and fishing in the evening and being critical critics the rest of the time. The lack of content of the conception of human nature has led some to dismiss it altogether. A favorite tactic in this enterprise is to quote the following line from Marx's thesis on Feuerbach, where he says, "The human essence is no abstraction inherent in each single individual. In its reality, it is the ensemble of social relations." Or another way of putting this is to say that Marx rejects any notion of substance or essence that is outside of history. Human nature is therefore conceived not as an Aristotelian substance, but as the historically evolving ensemble of social relations. Many have taken Marx to mean, in saying this, that our culturally determined capacity, what the Enlightenment thinkers called our second nature, defines us far more than our natural capacities. And insofar as people think that, I think that's absolutely true. Most of what makes us interesting as human beings is precisely what has defined us culturally. But this has also been taken to the extreme, to see human nature as essentially an empty vessel, a blank slate that is infinitely malleable. This sounds very progressive because it holds the promise that given the right political setup, anything is possible. This whole constellation of issues gets us into this well-known nature versus nurture debate. And to be sure, there are some very good reasons for rejecting a theory of human nature if by that one assumes that such a theory must entail support for fixed ahistorical qualities. The most oft-quoted paradigm of such a concept of human nature is undoubtedly that of Aristotle, who saw human nature as divided into those who are naturally free and those who are naturally slaves. When you justify a historical condition as due to an intractable nature, you inevitably become an apologist for a status quo that maintains oppression. And there are contemporary proponents of fixed human nature found in modern biology and genetics, call them the evolutionary psychologists. They're not simply apologists for slavery the way Aristotle was, but there are still big problems with that view of human nature. To reject a concept of human nature altogether, however, is to throw out the baby with the bathwater. A case in point, and here I refer to the most radical version of the denialism of human nature, was the one championed by the Stalinist science bureaucrat Trofim Lysenko. Lysenko dismissed any biological basis for human nature, claiming that the science of genetics was inherently reactionary. Human nature was completely determined, according to Lysenko, by the environment. And Lysenko extended this thesis from human nature to biological nature in general, particularly the nature of plants, which was his field. Using his position as a czar of the Soviet scientific establishment, he purged geneticists from the universities and research positions they held, seriously retarding Soviet science in this area for decades. His theories were also put into practice in Soviet agriculture, resulting in a devastating series of crop failures. The damage done by this exponent of the blank slate theory of human nature could not be understated. It is probably not accidental that Stalinist bureaucrats gravitated toward the blank slate theory of human nature, as it seemed to provide a veneer of theoretical justifications for their high opinion of their capacity to mold the masses in their image. Other examples of the devastating effects wrought by basic policy on the belief that human nature is infinitely malleable can be seen in Mao's Great Leap Forward, which was responsible for the starvation of millions, and the even more heinous actions of the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia in the 1970s, who thought they could remake the nature of human nature simply by dictating it. Given this sort of history, it is not difficult for opponents of Marxism like the evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker in his book, The Blank Slate, to have a go at those Marxists who deny that there is any such thing as human nature. Pinker and other evolutionary psychologists can be justly criticized for reducing human nature to the biological and genetic. But the question he raises deserves a serious response. We are, it seems, caught between the Scylla and Charybdis of either asserting a biological reductionism or an empty vessel theory of human nature. Pinker, however, is hardly the first to develop a critique of the blank slate. We can find such a critique decades ago from within the Marxist tradition in the work of Eric Fromm. Fromm noted that the quote, environmentalist point of view is essentially relativistic. According to it, man is a blank sheet of paper on which culture writes its text. He is molded by his society for better or worse being considered from an ethical or religious standpoint. The position taken, counterposing this, the position taken by Fromm is that man has an immanent goal, that man's biological constitution is the source of norms for living. He has the possibility for full development and growth, provided the external conditions that are given are conducive to him. Clearly, in order to cut this Gordian knot, we must somehow bring together in our theory of human nature the natural and the social. Here, I think, we have to go back philosophically, at least to Aristotle's view of nature as a dynamic substance having its own logic, what Fromm alludes to when he speaks of man's imminent goal. But Aristotle must be updated, because for him, substance, as we have seen, had no historical dimension. If we historicize Aristotle's notion of substance, we get something like Hegel's notion of spirit. Spirit is the collective consciousness of an epoch and a place in history, but it is also much more. It is the institutional structure and culture in which this collective consciousness is embedded. And although Hegel is considered an idealist philosopher, he was not the type of idealist who believed that human nature is infinitely malleable and can float freely above its foundations in the natural world. This is made even more explicit, this conjunction of the natural with the social, in Marx, who recognized both the natural and the social foundation of man. And let me quote once again Erich Fromm on this subject. The outstanding exception to the conventional environmental view that man is a blank tablet is that of Marx. Even though vulgar Marxism in its Stalinist or reformist version has done everything to obscure this. Marx proposed a concept of, quote, human nature in general, as distinct from, quote, human nature as modified in each historical epoch. For him, certain social conditions, such as capitalism, produce a crippled human being. Socialism, as he conceived it, will be conducive to the full realization of man. That's the end of my Fromm quote. What Marx lacked, however, was a mediating term to bring the two sides, the natural and the social, together. That mediating term is the dimension of human psychology which was first explored by Freud. The left Freudians took Freud's insights and refocused it into a critical theory of civilization and its discontents. The content of human nature need not remain empty. It can begin to be grasped through an investigation into character types and how different forms of society can either encourage or discourage creative or destructive character formations. And we can also investigate the internal dynamic of character formation, a dynamic that has its own logic and is relatively autonomous from its roots in biology and its expression in culture. Furthermore, the internal contradictions within the psyche and below the surface of consciousness can begin to shed light on the irrational choices that people often make. For instance, when they continually vote for political representatives who are hostile to their material interests. A Marxist theory of society and a political practice based on such remains incomplete without this critical dimension. We have seen in the previous presentations how the work of the left Freudians, such as Reich, Marcuse, and Fromm, filled in the gap in our conceptualization of human nature. At least I hope we have. We have also seen that not every attempt to fill in that gap is viable and might represent a false path in the end. And finally, I cannot finish without at least saying something about what I think was missing in the analysis of the left Freudians. If Marx had an empty place that he missed, then I think it's also fair to point to the empty place of the left Freudians. By this I mean that to varying degrees, they either did not recognize or simply rejected a crucial aspect of Marx's critique of political economy. That is to say, Marx was not only demonstrating that bourgeois social relations were a perversion of man's essential nature, he also demonstrated that the imminent movement of capitalist society was creating the conditions for its own supersession. Or to put it in the language of Hegel, alienation is a necessary moment in the labor of spirit, and without going through that necessary moment, it is not possible to overcome alienation. Without that critical dimension of Marx's theoretical outlook, socialism remains little more than an empty dream. Perhaps that is why many of the left Freudians, as brilliant and humanistic as they were, lost their way politically. Nevertheless, their contributions are invaluable. This work, tentative and unfinished as it is, allows us to conceptualize a concrete theory of human nature that retains all the revolutionary implications of the critique of political economy that Marx first announced in the 1844 manuscripts. And I was originally going to end there, but let me...
You're running out of time.
How much time do I have?
I think you have like 1 minute.
1 minute. Okay. In my 1 minute, I'm not going to be able to read anymore. I'll just say that not only should we consider the work of the left Freudians who theorized what a disalienated humanity might be like, but we should also consider the practical examples of the greatest experiment in history to create a socialist society, and that was the Russian Revolution. It's not by accident that one of the things that preoccupied the leader of the Bolsheviks, Leon Trotsky, in those years was not only winning the Civil War and getting the economy back to a point where people were not starving. He also wrote a series of essays called Problems of Everyday Life. And in there, he tried to approach the problem that the Bolsheviks had inherited a society that was culturally, not only was it very far from this disalienated view of humanity that we have been talking about, it was even very far from the norms of a standard capitalist country in Western Europe. He wrote there about problems such as alcoholism, the use of profanity, disrespect of women. These were serious issues that the Bolsheviks had to tackle, because they understood that man does not live by bread alone. And if you can't begin to at least plant the germs and the seeds of the new society after the revolution, then we have to, you know, then we have to conclude that the revolution in some way will fail. And in assessing this whole historical period, of course, that revolution eventually does fail. Whether you date the failure 75 years later or 10 years later.
Alex.
But revolutions, nevertheless, have to go through this messy historical process. There will be failures along the way, and the road to the new society and to the new man will go through what Hegel calls the intense labor of the negative.
I apologize for being absent for a bit. I'm in the middle of a rather nasty cold. But we will now field questions from the audience. Mitchell?
Yeah, first I just wanted to note and thank the younger people for staying here, and something that would be totally alienating, no doubt, to them in this talk about alienation. So I wanted to welcome you. I wanted to give you a couple of things, some writing, so that you might be interested in.
Do you have a question?
No, thanks. We only have some questions, or we do a lot.
Oh, yeah, comment or question.
Well, okay. Yeah, so...
But it has to be related.
There's... It seems to me that happiness is, since that was raised as a question, is what one feels when fulfilling a work of writing about unhappiness. That's that just seems, it's the process. It's the feeling you get from the process of doing work that you feel fulfilled by. And so I really don't know. Maybe my mind is getting slower these days. I just don't know what the big deal is in some of these questions. but like I wonder whether there'd be a, even a nature nurture false debate if the two words weren't spelled that way. You know, it's a convenient thing. But I did have a serious question for Frank. You mentioned that part of it, which is a really interesting paper, that fighting for utopianism, for one's vision, and in that way can lead to a repressive society, can lead to fascism, actually.
I was quoting Edward Rothstein.
Okay, well, you see, oh, okay, then I'd like you to clarify that, because you also paired that a little bit later within the 60s, when people were fighting against repression and for utopianism, and then you sort of had some negative comments about that, so I sort of thought those two were paired, right. And so I'd like you to comment on that.
Yeah, just sort of quickly, you know, there is, you know, I was talking about the, what I think is the prevailing zeitgeist, the prevailing view that utopianism, you know, the notion that there is a, there are alternatives to capitalism, is not something that is accepted within mainstream political culture, certainly in this country and throughout Western society. And I just used this quote by this right-wing Times journalist to exemplify that point. What I was trying to get at in terms of this concept of repression is a, you know, understood in a Freudian sense is as a sort of a dialectical concept. We need to educate children and socialize children and bring them up, and that is part of that is in a sense the education of the senses. It is a form of repression. Basic repression. Without that, people can't be humans. But there is an extra bit, there's an extra great deal of repression that is used to, you know, as Charles and Alex and others have talked about, disfigure humans psychologically in order to impose on them the roles of being, laborers in this society, exploited laborers in this society. So I think that on one hand there is that form of it. On the other hand, there is a kind of sort of nihilistic or simplistic rejection of all limits and all forms of education. And you know, I think in the 60s, I think people tended to get a little bit into that. All limits are bad and all rules are bad and all the rest of it. That isn't what. That isn't what liberating humanity is about. Liberating humanity is running away from responsibilities. It's a transformation of the nature of responsibility. Okay. Sorry.
If I can just comment, just to follow with just a brief comment.
Brief, sure. Very brief.
Yeah. That I think there's a distinction between repression and restraint. I mean, I think people can make conscious choices and learn to make conscious choices because of the values that they have. And that's not the same as repressing in the sense of making something unconscious.
Other questions?
Yes. Yeah, I think I have a question for all of you guys. We're kind of bouncing around this notion of positive freedom. I think you quoted Isaiah Berlin, and he misapprehends Kant when using Kantian ethics to oppose utopianism when he ignores the Kantian notion of positive freedom within the categorical imperative. I think Marx has a notion of positive freedom. I think that concept is an answer to the critique of utopianism and also points to Marx's conception of human nature as well. You guys can just comment on. I think it actually directly relates to what you just said.
Okay, yeah.
I just said, again, I think I'll be very brief, but you touched the idea of human power being developed as its own end. I mean, you could think of that as positive.
Yeah.
But you have to go through a negation of the negation to get there. It's not like you just go there.
Marx, in a letter to Arno Bruegel, says we have a categorical imperative to combat dehumanization and filth and degradation. There's also a constant critique of Kant as well, and his formalism, it's not to see that in German ideology. So I think the formalism of Kant, this idea of positive freedom, is developed further in Hegel's critique, and then Marx puts Hegel back on his head. So that's a very good point, and it's really good from the perspective of how the history of philosophy impacts Marx's roles.
Just quickly. Berlin and a liberal theorist like Berlin don't have a positive theory of human freedom. And their theory of human freedom consists is entirely negative. Freedom is simply not trampling on other people. But there's no positive content to it. And there's a reason for that, because ultimately they have a degraded view of human nature behind it all. They think that if you open up freedoms and open up that content, man, who is essentially this degraded animal, is going to misuse it and create atrocities. So it's the Hobbesian misanthropic vision that ultimately animates all this stuff.
Any other questions for you? Yes.
These aren't questions. I'm going to share with you all what I shared with the panel when I came in about 10 years ago. I came to the left forum with a name tag that said, "Hi, my favorite Marxian concept is species being." So obviously, I was delighted to find this panel. I'm not even going to attempt. I'm not a scholar, and I don't, but I'm just going to throw out some ideas that I have in response to this. First of all, whenever I hear people talk about Freud and Fromm and psychoanalysis and the evolution of human freedom, I always want to understand the practical side of it, the healing side of it, if I may use that word. And I realize that word is not anywhere in the Marxist lexicon, although, and I personally myself, would not have the capacity to experience as much species being if I had not gone through a healing process and continued to go through a healing process of my own, which is indeed, you could talk about that as maximizing pleasure and minimizing pain, but it's maximizing the pleasure of being here with you all today. It's maximizing the pleasure that is inherent in species being, even though I'm not sure Marx really talks about that. So that's one thing that I want to talk about. And minimizing pain, which means you have to have some way now to release the pain, to understand the difference between feeling feelings and acting on painful emotion.
That is
so. Anyway, let me finish. So now, Oz, I think, really does have something to do with the whole notion that Marx continues to use the term, the concept production. And I think my hunches are that production, really, the social relations of productions are male bonding. That production itself is a concept that functions under domination, inherently. And that the goal isn't production, free production, is to go from production into creation, into some kind of creativity. And sometimes I think, and this came to me today, was that who was the person who talked about the symbol? I think it was you. Somebody talked about symbols that are connected to reality, that the symbols are kind of sucked out of reality, and that by certain kinds of relations. And sometimes I think that the working class is a symbol. It's not an actuality. That Marxism projects as an actuality and then objectifies and locates out there. And the truth is that we have seen the working class and it is us.
Okay.
And if I were going to do anything really creative here, I would suggest that everybody get up and move these ridiculous chairs and mill around, talk to each other, touch each other. Anyway, that's
it. Okay. Well,
that's all.
We'll have it.
Thank you very much. This is wonderful.
Okay. But you're not suggesting it, are you?
No, I sort of get caught short. I mean, I've done it. But I mean, I would suggest it. Let's do that. I mean, I did.
Okay, maybe I can respond.
Sure.
Actually, I think there's just one way in which that Marx, the word healing and whole, actually wholeness and healing are actually the same root. And Marx is talking about wholeness, people regaining their wholeness. So in that sense,
yeah, but he doesn't have a process of healing.
I think the revolution is that
process. It's its own thing.
Okay,
but anyway, but I don't want to get into, I just want to say that. And just, I also, I'm going to have to say I'm not in agreement. I mean, he talks about productive life is life creating life. It's very much a creative process, and I don't. We may disagree, unless we're told that we had to have a disagreement.
Okay.
He's talking about reducing production to the minimum possible, so that we can create, and that's the session.
Any other questions?
Yes.
I have a question for Charles, and I'm interested in your practice. Director of Psychological Services at a hospital. And I wanted to know, especially with the healing question, how does I guess, Marxism or everything that you spoke of inform your practice?
I have, for many years now, been trying to transform the way that we interact with each other, both in our meetings. We are able to take time to connect with ourselves in terms of what is our true aliveness, and it is a struggle because there are all these pressures, even in a hospital, to need a certain number of visits and how we do that. But I try to engage the whole department that I'm in a collective process of how we respond to these things. It's a challenge because I get pressure from all sides, but I'm very conscious about trying to transform the workplace to a place where we connect with each other. As much as possible.
Yeah.
Questions,
my question is to you, and I'd like to understand what you've been accusing Lacan of, because I understand very well your criticism about Zizek, who proclaimed himself Marxist philosophist, thinker, philosopher, and he is not. But Lacan, I try to understand what you were accusing him of, not being a Marxist. And your arguments were like so very strange, the way you started criticizing Lacan about localizing the about thinking that the unconscious is not something like a locus or a space into which things are deposited, like your brain or your heart or something. And I mean, it's surprising even more, because you can have a critique of somebody of not being a Marxist, for instance, but talking about
Lacan
saying that Lacan misunderstood Freud about the unconscious, where he's the person who understood what Freud meant by the unconscious, which is something that Freud invented or discovered, if you want. Okay, I just don't understand what Lacan had to do in your presentation. Zizek's understanding of Lacan and his discussion, I totally agree with you. But why did you bring Lacan in the theme of your discussion? I'd like you to explain this to me, and what is your objection about the unconscious being structured as a language, and what you understand out of it, and what you have to say against that?
We could do informal, because we want to get out of
here. All right.
Zizek is a card-carrying Lacanian.
There's a lunch period after this.
Oh, and okay. His arguments about these transcendental registers come from Lacan. So you really can't...
Permanent-revolution.org. I don't know what we'll do with it as far as that website goes. We'll probably post something about
what we've done here on the website, and haven't worked it out yet. Yes?
Wondered if anyone had a comment on kind of the Vygotskian tradition as possibly within psychology and Marxism as kind of possibly in relation to the conundrum between the blank slate and biological determinism. But in that, Vygotsky more or less is saying that biology, there's sort of a biological substrate that evolved through natural selection and so forth. But at this point in cultural history, our psyches are very much formed by our collective activities with each other, our internalization of language and psychological tools. And actually that makes our human nature very malleable, but ultimately based on collective labor, collective activity, which is what we're trying to throw off the yoke of and actually liberate so that we can, you know, become unalienated and so forth. But is that, you know, another way of looking at this, that our minds reflect our material activity and are formed that way? And so there's quite a bit of possibilities. We can actually free ourselves from the domination that people talk so well about.
You wanted to say something? Go ahead.
Not specifically about Vygotsky, but I do want to just pause it because of the whole discussion about human nature. That just because it's malleable doesn't mean it's arbitrary. In other words, human beings have very specific needs, and it's not like arbitrary that this is okay. You know, there's a way in which our human nature has an integrity in terms of how it develops. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean it's, the fact that it's not fixed doesn't mean that it can be any other thing.
But to put it another way, it's malleable, but only within certain limits.
But even there, even if not, there's an integrity to the realization of the person's potential.
There's a certain structure to it.
There's a structure to it.
Just a footnote to that. Vygotsky was, I think, is a major figure and an important figure.
I agree.
And I think his stuff deserves to be known better. He wrote a very interesting paper on Freud in the late 20s, but the winds of Stalinism were blowing very strong at that point, and he wasn't able to really explore that side of things. I mean, I don't think he would have become a Freudian in any case, but I think he was quite interested in that and saw in that something aligned to what he himself was trying to do.
Any other questions? Just one more?
Well, I like that comment also, the one about healing, because I think it's important that we do look at the dark side of human nature too, including what's happened on the left with a lot of hierarchical societies. I think it's a deep question that the left has to look at more. I think it can be overcome by cultural intelligence.
We have our own version of power over.
Like in this diagram that you gave out, which column is like about the idea of human nature possibly as having the ability for horrible evil and also fabulous good, that we're born with all of those, to be jealous, to be very caring, just almost that it's maybe all of that is potentially innate in us, but that it's culture that either encourages one or the other.
Well, I think human nature has the capacity to be perverted from its natural goal, let's put it that way. And when it's perverted, it can be perverted in some very destructive directions. But human nature properly as such is not destructive.
You mean like we're not born with the potential to be evil?
How do you clarify that? What is goal?
I think its goal is the same as the goal of socialism. It's the society of cooperative producers, and the kind of social psychology that is in accordance with that. Eric Fromm, one of his last books was called "To Have and to Be,"
or to be.
Did I say antivy? Sorry. And he characterized the alienated consciousness as consciousness in which to have is the primary theme, whereas the a consciousness that, or a psychology that has overcome alienation is one characterized by to be. And to be, he fills this out. Putting it into a slogan, but It means treating others respectfully. It means allowing yourself to dictate what direction you wish to take, and to investigate your capacities to their fullest extent. But anyway.
Anyone else?
This is not a question, but a comment. The capacity for cooperation and solidarity, it seems to me, it shows itself in social movements and in natural disasters. And once the day-to-day social relations of capitalist society are either broken through or collapsed, this capacity shows itself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we want to respond?
I don't disagree. I not only don't disagree, I think that, in fact, there's a journalist here in the States who has written very eloquently about that, how, in fact, in natural disasters like in Haiti and other places, there's a natural cooperation that develops among those who are trying to recover from the disaster, and that's very quickly squelched by the authorities because they don't like that. They want immediately to impose, you know, all in the name of so-called efficiency, whereas in fact those spontaneously developing structures are incredibly efficient and indicate a natural desire of a human natural desire of people to help each other.
I want to just say something about that, and it's something that falls on something William James wrote about the moral equivalent of war. Actually, in wartime, people have solidarity, they sacrifice for each other, they have socialized medicine, they have all these things, and people remember their war experiences, even if they were horrifying and everything, because of the bond and the connection that they had as human beings with other human beings. So this does fulfill us in a profound, even war.
I think we should
have
a formal discussion.
One more. Let's take one more.
Do we not have to consider the shock doctrine of how many years catastrophe, some people take advantage of it, and would we not have to say that there's more than one human nature? Those who exploit.
Well, I don't think we have a different human nature, but people meet their needs in different ways.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you all for coming.
Special doesn't remember that we met.
No, when did we meet?
You should circulate an email.
They like to perpetuate the LNA talking about it, so that it gives them authority. And not these particular people, but in general, the way the structure is set up. Amazing how people can talk abstractly about these things.
You cannot say anything, get away with it. Intellectual authority.
Hey!
He writes clearly. There are songs that work to exclude.